Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 45, J.K. Rowling's Alchemical Weddings. Today we will be talking with Elizabeth Baird Hardy and Beatrice Groves about the symbolism of alchemical marriages in J.K. Rowling's work. For joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Our resident expert is John Granger, the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars and author of numerous books about the Harry Potter series, including the Deathly Hallows Lectures. How are things going for you in Oklahoma today, John?
We're beautiful! We've got great weather. We're pretty much out of lockdown. So life is good here in the center, the heartland, the center of the heartland.
Oh, nice. Very good. Very good. Joining us today also, more toward the east side of the country, where I am too, is Elizabeth Baird Hardy, a senior instructor of English at Mayland Community College in Western North Carolina. And she's the author of Milton, Spencer, and the Chronicles of Narnia, along with a number of articles on Harry Potter in critical collections and on HogwartsProfessor.com. Welcome back, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
And we are also pleased to have on the show Beatrice Groves, Oxford Fellow and tutor in Renaissance English, author of Literary Illusion in Harry Potter, and blogger at MuggleNet's Batilda's Notebook. Welcome back to the show, Bea.
Hi, Katie. Lovely to be here.
We had so much fun last time with this group when we were talking about what to expect in the next Cormoran Strike book. And now we're going to turn our attention to talking about literary alchemy and particularly a particular facet of literary alchemy. And I just wanted to start by giving a little reminder about literary alchemy, which is a technique that authors use to transform the reader by evoking symbols of alchemy and the process of alchemical change. And that change happens through phases that proceed from the negretto, the black phase, the breakdown, to the albedo, the white phase, which represents purification, and then to the rubedo, or transformative success, the culmination, and that's the red phase. That's very simple rundown on literary alchemy, and we've talked, John, you and I, a lot about how literary alchemy is playing out in the Harry Potter series. That's an idea that you had brought to the series, and it's really amazing to see not only the color combinations, but you know, how that is affecting the reader as we go through those stories. But today, we are going to talk about an additional aspect to the alchemical process, which has to do with the way certain elements in alchemy are combined to produce desired chemical reactions or changes. And so, John, I thought maybe you should start us out here with a little primer.
Oh, boy.
On what are some of the combinations that are important in alchemy and how that we might anticipate that that would be expressed through literature. Help us out here, John.
Whoa. Well, I was hoping that you were going to go to Professor Groves, who has really joined the professoriate, the alchemical professoriate.
She's on the alchemy bandwagon.
I shouldn't say alchemy bandwagon. I mean, I have teased Professor Groves since her brilliant book, Literary Illusion, came out, where she didn't talk about alchemy. And her first response was, well, John, you already did that, which is a nice British way of saying, I don't want to go there, John. That's for crazies like you. But several years after, though, she has, through her work with plants and such, joined the crowd, and most recently has written a three-part series at MuggleNet on her Batilda's Notebook, has written three wonderful pieces on literary alchemy, especially on the literary side. She doesn't talk much about the three stages, much more about Solway and Coagula, which was the point of these things, was Rowling's tattoo. She's got an alchemical tattoo now. But anyway, if we're going to go to the old man rather than the new blood scholar in literary alchemy, the certain combinations important in alchemy are going to be humoral, are going to be combinations of the hot and cold and the dry and the moist. In alchemy, to cut right to the, because this is a short talk here. There's this actual event in the usual three-stage process called the alchemical wedding, where the Red King and the White Queen are married. It's usually considered a marriage of the choleric and the phlegmatic, the hot and dry and the cold and moist. That's expressed in literature through characters like Bill Weasley and Fleur Delacour. these characters are drawn to each other, and what we see in that combination, though, is not so much these characters' marriage, but their death. They literally dissolve into one another, so they're no longer what they were originally. And this is the point of alchemy: is you're going to see a dissolution of a person's ego identity, their static historical self, to their prime matter, their logos existence, their inner essence. And then after that soul has been separated by dissolution from its improper combination with the person, then they're going to combine again, the coagula part of this, where that person will be reassembled as a more perfect union. And dissolution and coagulation is represented in the process as a step in between the purification stage and the coagulation stage. The white and the red stages is actually considered sometimes a yellow stage, quincinatus, and that's where that wedding happens. How is that expressed through literature? All sorts of marriages, and we're going to talk about that today, I assume. And characters identify with this and see these weddings somehow as a death towards a new life. Is that too much or too little?
No, that's great. I think that sets us up really nice to have this conversation about these weddings, and remembering, of course, that the point is to show human transformation. And I'm a romantic, and so I love the idea that there's this way that can be represented through characters getting married. Like, I love all of the Shakespeare comedies where, like, everybody ends up, like, happily combined in the end, happily, happily wedded. My heart goes pitter-pat. And so I love those elements of Harry Potter as well. I like the epilogue. I'm sorry, don't hate me. But I like that kind of thing where you can kind of see how all the combinations are made. So I really like the idea that that's not just, that's not just something surface, but that it actually has to do with a fundamental, change that is a beneficial, transformative change for the two individuals in that couple. So that's great. So let's turn to talking a little bit about where we see that in Harry Potter.
And I love that you mentioned the Shakespearean comedy, because that is the whole difference between a Shakespearean comedy and a Shakespearean tragedy is, do we put pieces back together, or do we end with things being restored, or do we end with everything being scattered? And so that's the difference between Hamlet. Everything's all over the map. Everything's all dissolved in little pieces at the end. Or Much Ado About Nothing, where everything is put back together again. My students always joke around when I teach Midsummer Night's Dream that the end of that play and many other Shakespearean comedies is like an episode of Oprah. You get a wedding, and you get a wedding, and you get a wedding. Everybody gets a wedding. Because it is. It's like, hey, you crazy kids, anybody in the audience want to get married? All right, come on up. Because it's that sort of, but that's because, and a dance, because both the dance and the wedding represent order, represent things being put back the way they're supposed to be, a better order, as John says, putting it back and taking those pieces that we took them apart usually in the third act, and then we put them all back together at the end. So That's something you definitely can see as we think about the alchemical wedding. So, and of course we see that in Harry Potter. We see those opposites coming together and putting them in those pieces. And as John mentions too, very important. It's not just the two pieces. It's often those four elements that you're dealing with the humors. So like you, Katie, I love the epilogue because I like a good Shakespearean comedy. And when you know, are we building on the scaffolding of a comedy, or we're building on the scaffolding of a tragedy, that does let you know what to expect. You know, do I need tissues, or for what reason do I need tissues at the end of this story? Are we going to be put back together again? At the risk of getting booed, I hope not. I remember I was very relieved when I was reading Breaking Dawn and realized that the book that the page was torn out of to use for a note was a comedy, not a tragedy. It's all going to work out. It'll all be okay. We'll get back to a comedy. But when we look at some of those connections throughout Harry Potter, of course, Bill and Fleur is one of the obvious ones. And of course, Ron and Hermione, which is, you know, they argue. And so the quarreling couple, the two that are they're always after each other all the time. We always, you know, think, gosh, do they ever start? You know, I'm always mad at him. But because of that, they are able to come together and they are able to create something better in the end. So that's a perfect example is Ron and Hermione, but also, of course, Bill and Fleur, because we see the humors as well. So these things that don't seem alike, they don't seem like they're going to work, but they do. And so that's but in the process, sometimes it is very painful. It is that breaking down. It is things that we were comfortable with. We lose those things in the process. So very often it is somebody literally dying. So we have Remus and Tonks. You know, both of them die, but then they have their son who is sort of the replacement Harry, the Harry that would have been if he had had people to take care of him other than his horrible aunt and uncle. So we see that same kind of process happening there. But that's just one example. Goodness, there are so many.
Two quick points there before Bea jumps in with her brilliance. Is the Ron and Hermione, as you said, are the quarreling couple. They're not necessarily the alchemical wedding per se, and that's just a distinction of where their union happens. That has to happen at the very finish. That quarreling couple thing between alchemical mercury and alchemical sulfur. That's why he's Bilious, etc. His middle name is Bilious. But that the Remus and Tonks' wedding is important because of the death, because that's really what's supposed to happen at the chemical wedding. Is the couple is supposed to die immediately, and but their conjunction is somehow supposed to give you the philosophical orphan, which is Harry Potter. So in a way, Harry's parents, Lily and James, are the first alchemical wedding of opposites, and we see in Memories of the Pensieve how they're real contraries, and they're in a way a quarreling couple, but they come together and they die. And the philosophical orphan, who's already born, takes his place as the stone really to be transformed. And Harry goes through that process. I said that very quickly, hoping that Bea would jump in.
I wanted to follow up on the Shakespeare idea, and look at what I think is his most alchemical play, which is Romeo and Juliet, because there you get the quarrelling couple. So in Juliet and Romeo, that it's not that they're quarrelling, it's that they're the representations of two quarrelling families. They marry and their marriage ends in death, and there's actually quite a lot of alchemical imagery of the lovers uniting in a tomb, so that moment of the love dissolving and dying, and there's loads of that imagery of uniting in a tomb, and obviously literally Romeo comes and joins Juliet when she is entombed at the end of the play. But one of the things that makes it so alchemical is that their death reunites the two quarrelling families. So the end of the play, the Montagues and the Capulets are united. They recognise that they've got to get over this strife, and they symbolise that by raising two golden statues of the lovers. So the way in which that dissolution of contraries has been expressed through gold is quite astonishingly alchemical, I think.
Doesn't the prince raise the statue?
Yes, the prince.
Not the family. Yeah, the families are still having problems.
Yeah, the families say they will get over it. the prince says the statues will be raised. Yes, but it's a symbol of the reuniting of these two sides. I think it's very striking that they're in gold.
So you all have brought some tragedy into my comedy with the way you're talking about these alchemical weddings, right? That there's the death, and sometimes that literally means the death of the couple, right? With Lily and James, or Tonks and Remus, or Romeo and Juliet.
Interestingly enough, it's funny. Romeo and Juliet technically isn't a textbook tragedy in a Shakespearean sense. It doesn't follow the tragic hero's role and all that kind of thing. It does kind of its own thing, and because it's a little different than a tragedy, because you don't have the fall of the tragic hero with the tragic flaw and all those kinds of things as much. Instead, we focus then on that resolution. But yes, it does have a sad side. It's not just a happily ever after.
There's a great book by Susan Snyder called The Comic Matrix of Shakespeare's Tragedies, which is really difficult to get hold of. I don't know why. In Oxford, there's only one missing copy, so it's really, really difficult to get hold of. But it's great on the way in which Shakespeare keeps selling Romeo and Juliet to you as a comedy. You know, the basic movement of a comedy, want to get together, the old people want to stop them, and the young lovers get together anyway. And that's, you know, that's sort of basic movement of comedy. And that happens in Romeo and Juliet. And so you think what you're getting, the young overgoing the old for the sake of love, you think you're getting Midsummer Night's Dream, as it were. And there's loads and loads of echoes of Romeo and Juliet in Midsummer Night's Dream. But then, so even things like the death of Paris, which is really grim, but it does sort of enable the sense that maybe Romeo and Juliet will be allowed to get together because the person who her family want her to marry is gone, things like that. And then obviously he's setting you up for a fall. So all that comedic message that you're getting, that this is what you're in, it doesn't happen, and it is a tragedy. But that fits very nicely with the alchemical imagery being fundamentally a comic imagery, or comedic imagery. Works very nicely for the way in which he's using it. On that note, a sort of much wider note, but we're also getting a very strongly Christian image here. And yes, loads of alchemical texts use the gospel phrase about if a grain of wheat doesn't fall to the ground, it can't rise again. And and so that sense in which a death that brings through you to a resolution is a Christian message, and it's also obviously central to what happens to Harry. So Harry has to go through something that's very like a death at the end before he can rise again, and that his rising again enables the tincture of everyone. So the Dunn says, you know, that when Christ lies down, he lies down all gold. He is perfect when he dies, but it's only through the death that he can become all tincture, meaning that through his death he can purify everyone, not just pure himself. And that sort of happens to Harry as well, where he's good when he dies, but after his death he says, now, you know, Voldemort, you can't touch them because I have died for them, they're all okay. And that sort of is what's happening with Romeo and Juliet's death as well. They, you know, they don't need to resolve their own quarrel, they are already united, but through their death they bring resolution to their society.
Oh, that was beautiful. That was beautiful. And one of the other, I love how Katie mentioned, you know, you're riding on my parade with this. And I sometimes have that with this, especially with students struggling to understand that happy endings don't always, you know, are not like your rom-com happy endings. It is that resolution. It is that idea that something beautiful is born, and it may not look like what we normally think of. And one that I run into that with quite a bit is The Scarlet Letter, which certainly is very alchemical. And just the cover of the book should tell you that, just the colors. But the idea that, and my students are always frustrated, why can't Hester and Dimmesdale get together? Why doesn't it work out? But there's Pearl. And so that's, the kind of the idea that no, it can't. You can't always get those sort of putting a bow on it, happy endings. But it is because something is destroyed, it is broken down, and then what is created is greater. But that doesn't always sort of maybe fit our sort of Hollywood idea. But it definitely is a Christian idea. It is that where we get the same idea of the eucatastrophic ending, that you can have a happy ending, if you will, air quotes there, that isn't necessarily what we would think of as the normal happy ending. So that idea that, yes, Romeo and Juliet, it's a satisfactory ending. It's an appropriate ending. And it isn't necessarily something that we think of as being, fun and Midsummer Night's Dream kind of ending. But it does have that sense of purpose that is so much deeper than just a, yay, and they all lived happily ever after.
Yeah, so I wanted to follow up on what John and B mentioned, this idea of the philosophical orphan who is the result of the wedding, which I think is really interesting. And I wonder what does that mean in alchemical terms? So you've had the wedding and the result that is, I guess, the coagula part, the combination part,
exactly,
is the child.
Exactly.
And so what's the meaning of that phrase, the philosophical orphan, and what are we readers supposed to get from that?
To continue on from what B said, and maybe to answer your question, Katie, is that, traditionally speaking, marriage is, and the sexual act itself is known as a death. It's the equivalent for lay people of the monastic vow and the marriage to Christ himself, that the person is going to transcend self in the other, the altar, and the altar and the Edom will meet, the other and the same will become conjoined in this marriage. There's a third person in the marriage who is Christ. And the sexual act, which will consummate the marriage, is known as a death, is experienced as a death. But from that death, there'll be a rebirth. There'll be a coagulation, quite literally, in the case of conception. And then this child will be born. And they call it the philosophical orphan because the married element, which is actually supposed to be, one person represented here, that person dies and is born again. And is born in a way without parents, hence the philosophical orphan. Is the inner essence exteriorized of that couple. Harry is Lily and James conjoined, and in their death, given that life. This is pretty heady stuff, but in terms of literature, this is what's happening. We enter into the story, we identify with the action of the protagonists and the antagonists, and so as we identify with the cardiac players, the players represent our noetic selves, and they go through this crucible of transformation, the Solway and coagula. We experience that imaginatively as well, and we're transformed. So the philosophical orphan is critical because that's the end game. That's where you're supposed to wind up. And if the story begins with a philosophical orphan, you're following that orphan through the process of his purification, and where Harry becomes, as B pointed out, after his choice for death, his personal Solway and coagula in the crisis points of Deathly Hallows, when he comes out of that and confronts the Dark Lord, the game is over. He's already won the battle against death. What does the Dark Lord really represent to him as a threat? He's a touchstone, in a way, a philosopher's stone to everyone around him. Did that answer your question, Katie?
It sure did. Yeah, that's very interesting. And, I was thinking that we would talk a lot about, Ron and Hermione. And so it's interesting to me that we're actually talking about, some other instances of alchemical weddings. It's taking it in a different direction than what I'd anticipated.
Well, I'm going to jump in again. The Ron and Hermione are a quarreling couple. And the Romeo and Juliet model is perfect for this because there's a quarreling couple inside Romeo and Juliet as well. You've got Tybalt and Mercutio. Not especially difficult imagery there, just in the names. Mercutio representing alchemical mercury, right? So both of them die their deaths. But it's their conflict which sets the whole thing in motion. They're really the catalyst to the story. And Ron and Hermione, though they do come together in the very finish, it's their friction, their constant quarreling, that is a catalyst to Harry's transformation, as tired as he gets sometimes of their bickering, that they're not really an alchemical couple per se. I mean, the big alchemical moment, I think, in the entire series doesn't happen. It happens before the wedding of Floor and Bill. It happens in the hospital wing at the end of Half-Blood Prince, where Floor is, you know, Bill has been laid out by the Fenrir Greyback, and Mrs. Weasley, who despises Floor as phlegmatic, they even call her phlegm, right? I mean, and the choleric Mrs. Weasley doesn't think she's a fit wife for her son, and pretty much says, you know, too bad that this wedding's not going to come off because he's so disabled and disfigured now. And Floor turns total choleric and lays into Mrs. Weasley, and everyone holds their breath waiting for her to get, you know, to respond as Mrs. Weasley responds. Instead, Mrs. Weasley becomes phlegmatic and peaceable and makes a comment about, you know, the tiara that she's going to offer that. And then both of them hug each other. Each one of them has died and turned into the opposite, and the wedding really has happened at that moment. Bill, representing the alchemical wedding, he's all but dead. You know, I mean, so the other characters around his marriage have to die to themselves and become something different as well. And they do, hence the strength of the wedding, where the families actually can join.
That's beautiful. I love that, John. My romantic heart just loves all that Bill and Floor stuff. So that was wonderful. Now, I think we've done a pretty good job giving at least a sense of the alchemical weddings that are happening in Harry Potter. This is something that J.K. Rowling's just very interested in, alchemy and, you know, these kind of, and of course she has the tattoo that suggests that she's very interested in those, you know, chemical combinations. So where do we see these alchemical weddings playing out in the Fantastic Beasts series?
Yeah, with the name Goldstein, that's the moment where it's most obvious in the Fantastic Beasts. So, Goldstein is a German Yiddish name meaning gold stone, and it was used as a touchstone. So it was used as it's topaz or chrysolite, and it was used as a touchstone by alchemists. So the Goldstein sisters have both a name that obviously means gold, and we're, you know, they're being held up as the thing toward which the men are seeking. But they also are themselves, they have an alchemical name, a touchstone name. So I think Newt and Jacob are going to be sort of not only seeking them, but tested by that quest. So they're on that sort of alchemical quest for Queenie and Tina, and they're going to be tested in that journey. But I also particularly like the fact that the Nifflers in the latest film, Crimes of Grindelwald, are used to find Tina. So he takes the Nifflers with him to find her, and there's that extraordinary sort of magic we've never seen before where they seek where she's been stepping. And they, of course, we've never seen the Nifflers doing that before. What they seek is gold. So the fact that they can find out where Tina has been is a sign that she is gold. And I really like as well that the Nifflers introduced in Goblet of Fire, which is the central. So John and I are always talking about this as the central pivot novel, so that the idea is that something as alchemical as something that can find gold, i.e. the Nifflers are sort of an animal version of a touchstone, is in the central novel of the Harry Potter series, and then turns up in Fantastic Beasts in this crucial role, both of finding Tina as the metaphorical gold, but also that golden thing, the treasure object that it turns out the Niffler will steal at the end of the movie.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And, you know, I'm just thinking now about the fact that the Niffler at the very beginning of the first Fantastic Beasts film, that's how Newt meets Tina. So the Niffler brings Newt and Tina together in the very beginning as well.
Yeah, that's right. And Jacob as well. So bringing those four together.
Right. John?
I want to take it. Of course, I there should be a moment of silence after B blows us away with something like that. But I hate to go on to the next thing and like, oh, that was nothing. Here's my trivial thing.
I know that was amazing.
Really, I think when you think about Fantastic Beasts, and I tried to do very little of that, forgive me. What you need to do is look at the ensemble cast portrait that they made for The Crimes of Grindelwald, that had the four couples in a picture between Dumbledore and Grindelwald, who are on the opposite posts. And that ensemble picture I've taken apart in a long post at Hogwarts Professor. Essentially, we have Dumbledore and Grindelwald as the quarreling couple established as the series. They're the poles of the portrait, and everything about them is different. You know, Dumbledore is sitting there with his arms shut over a closed coat, and Grindelwald has his arms wide open, and his jacket is open. They're holding their wands in different hands, etc. I mean, that picture sets them up as the quarreling couple of the series, and you see that all the polarity inside the story is going to be between them, you know, moving their forces in different directions against each other. But the four couples in the center set this up as a humoral comedy that Theseus and Leda and Nagini and Credence and Tina and Newt and Quinny and Jacob represent a humoral quality, so that Jacob and Quinny are sanguine, they're enthusiastic, they're funny, they're sociable people. That's an easy match. The choleric couple are going to be Leda and Theseus, you know, angry and overbearing. Newt and Tina are melancholic, which most people think of as sad, which is an extrovert's put down. They're actually just thoughtful people. They don't wave pom-poms even when they're playful and enthusiastic. This is the quiet, smart set, the humble, deep crowd. And then there's Credence and Nagini. When I first put this together, I wrote Bea about it, and she said, "I've seldom seen someone more phlegmy than Credence." And I did that. So the four elements work that way. And if you look at that picture, you know too much about humoral theory and humoral comedies. I mean, Rowling has featured Johnson's Every Man and His Humor on her website, the cover of it. You know, she's aware of how this works, that we're supposed to follow these humoral things to see how they're resolved between the quarreling couple of Dumbledore and Grindelwald. Anyway, much more than you wanted to know, but it certainly is a different type of alchemical comedy than what we saw in Harry Potter. It's almost as if Rowling is stretching her wings here a little bit. She's not doing this by the straight formula, probably for the different medium, I assume. But it's a different thing. We've got four couples. There's four couples in the ensemble that are featured as couples. And then there's the couple of Dumbledore and Grindelwald always in the background stirring the pot.
I, after John, I'm like, I don't want to just say something kind of light after that. I love, Bea, how you pointed out about the Niffler, because one of the things that Rowling always does so beautifully and that we love so much is she takes those things that don't seem important. And that's why you have to watch carefully, and why we get so much when we go back and read again, because there are things there that we just thought Anthony Goldstein was just a kid at Hogwarts. Who cares about Anthony, right? But there's that name. And then we bring it back up again. We just thought the Niffler was a joke in Goblet of Fire. He's just funny. And, you know, and then digging things up and just a little bit of an aside so that we can hide a body, a bone, really. So we don't think that there's much to the Niffler, but the Niffler, I think, is so important because it does seek out the gold. It also does that interesting thing with layers. And so as we think about all those humoral couples, everything is about layers, and everything is about insides and outsides. And so I know, John, not super enthusiastic about Fantastic Beasts, but the Newt's bag, which is one of my favorite things to talk about anyway, the idea that the inside of it is, of course, much bigger. It's even better than Hermione's bag because you can go inside it and you can walk around and do things in there. And it's the whole world inside that bag. But what I find fascinating is that we could legitimately put that bag inside the Niffler's pouch. The Niffler, and then the Niffler has babies, which fit inside the pouch. So it's all this idea of where's really the inside? Where's really the outside? And so that in itself is sort of this, because what alchemy does so beautifully with its resolution of contraries is it's a paradox. It defies those kinds of conventions. How can you bring two unlike things together? And really that's kind of the beauty of it, is because that's what marriage is. That's what, the whole spiritual representation of alchemy is that almost impossible. How is this even possible? It is. It's an impossible. It's a possible impossibility. And so we have that idea with the Niffler as well. So I'm so glad that you pointed that out about the gold, because it all works so beautifully with this entire package.
That's really neat. So that, you know, that gives me some hope for the next movie. I think she's got a plan for it. I think the screenwriting's not the easiest way for her to express her ideas, maybe. I'll be nice about that there. But, I'll watch all the movies. And I do think that there's some more really interesting things coming in that series. So now we know some things to be tuned into on the alchemical front there. And the other series, of course, that J.K. Rowling is in the middle of producing are the Cormoran Strike books. Do we see literary alchemy playing out in Cormoran Strike?
There's relatively little of it. What we're getting, though, in the main couple of Cormoran Strike, which, of course, is Robin and Cormoran, besides the mythological, the essential mythological Castor and Pollux symbolism going on there, is that both of these couples are going through a Solway and Coagula. Mm-hmm. Both of them tried to unite themselves to an opposite. Cormoran with his insane girlfriend, and Robin with Louise Freeman always calls him the flubberworm Matt, you know, despicable Matt. And they both tried to unite themselves to these couples in a way to put off Solway and Coagula. They wanted to, you know, identify with this other person and be safe inside that person rather than who they were. They didn't want to die to themselves in their relationships. They wanted to celebrate themselves and the great victory of the great match that they made in these relationships. And that is the opposite of the alchemical process. That's the opposite of an alchemical wedding. And so we've seen those relationships and how disastrous they are and how difficult they are for the person to get on with their lives until they've really put those relationships behind them. And those relationships can repeatedly strike relationship with Cormoran, you know, his relationship with Charlotte is repeatedly referred to as a virus, which has reservoired inside him that he can still feel, even though he seems to have, you know, gotten over it in Lethal White. When she reappears, he feels some stirring of it. That idea of safety and this marvelous achievement of beauty and riches that Charlotte represents, but she's poison to him. And the whole the nightmare of Robin's marriage, her actual wedding, where her rightful soulmate and, you know, Solway and Coagula buddy shows up. And she kisses him, and that's really the alchemical wedding that happens at the start of Lethal White. She marries Matt instead. And so we have to go through – it becomes part of her Solway where she gives that up. But neither one of them has really coalesced into what their identity really is about, at least in terms of their relationships. What they have is a love for the truth. You know, they seek the truth. They want to find out. Who has decided to kill other people? That's, you know, to find the murderer, okay? Someone who has not accepted the other as the same, the alter as Edem. That person is the ultimate criminal, and they will find that person because they are about a conjunction of the other as the same. They're offering murder is the absolute opposite of the death that you get in an alchemical wedding. It's the assertion of self before other in murder, the ultimate, you know, assertion of self over other. They're against that, and they're going to reveal that person who's trying to conceal that. They're going to that's their resolution of that drama. But we're seeing their coming, we hope, alchemical wedding, where eventually Cormoran and Robin will see that they share this inner essence and have their own alchemical wedding.
John, I love that you point that out about the Castor and Pollux, and because of all the swans, we see so much with the swans, obviously, with that. But also the swan, if, for those of us who are big fairy tale fans, we're always thinking about the ugly duckling. And so there's that idea of, they're trying to force themselves into the duck family. You know, you can't live in the duck family. It's just not going to work. You have to go and be with the other swans. But that's very much that same idea of trying to find that fit, to find that match. So it is, it's much more subtle, but that idea of sacrifice, self-sacrifice versus the sacrifice of others for yourself, is it is more subtle, but it's definitely going to be there with somebody who is as steeped in all this great alchemical material as Rowling. It's not going to go away. I don't think she could get rid of it if she tried.
When you started out there, John, I was sort of thinking, oh, maybe that was a silly question that I asked, but it is that there's something important to say there. I'm impressed with what you guys have said about that. That's interesting. And again, more food for thought as additional volumes of that come out. Well, thank you all so much for helping to educate us some in the importance of the alchemical wedding and, just being aware of that in all of J.K. Rowling's works, I think. And I don't know, we've got the Ichabod. Well, maybe we've got to think about some alchemy in the Ichabod. Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth Baird Hardy and Beatrice Groves, for helping us to explore the transformative power of the union of opposites.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think these are good thoughts for the times that we are living in today. Thanks to you, John, for being my co-host.
A pleasure always, Katie.
And a big thank you to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Thanks, Emma. You are the best. As always, we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. And our MuggleNet producer, Lori Beckoff. Dear listeners, we are so glad you joined us today, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or question for us. You can share your thoughts at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, readwriteroll on Twitter, or on our Facebook page. I am mixing up our closing quote just a bit, given the crisis that we're collectively experiencing due to COVID-19. And now also the turbulence in America about police brutality against African Americans. And in these troubling times, I think it's important to go to, the literary wisdom that is to be found in some of the most important texts in our lives. And for me, that's definitely Harry Potter. I'm going to leave you now with some wisdom from Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Happiness can be found even in the darkest of times, if one only remembers to turn on the light." Please join us next time when we'll be turning on the light with the help of a little Harry Potter magic.